Black Friday at BJ's Wholesale Club is so big, we called in the expert at paying less around the holidays.
Scrooge here. Past, present, or future, it's hard to beat the Black Friday deals at BJ's. Believe me, I've tried. Get 25% off select toys, 30% off select small appliances, and 45% off select TVs through December 1st. Plus, doorbuster deals Thanksgiving weekend. These prices are so good they even rattled old Marley's chain. Ah, humbug. Sorry, old habit.
Visit BJ's.com/Black Friday for holiday savings.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
It is January 2016. I'm sitting at my cramped desk at Garda headquarters in Dublin, in the corner of the document and handwriting examination section. There's a large working area behind me in the center of the room, but I like to work at my desk, cocooned from distraction and able to focus on my task. My microscope sits on the desk, but I don't use it much. There's a stack of paper files beside it, with all manner of cases in them. My desk is old and wooden. The red carpet under my feet is threadbare. The wallpaper on the wall over my desk is peeling in spots. There's no glamour here. This isn't high-tech. My work is a very human skill. I analyse handwriting.
And that is the voice of former Detective John Sweetman in his new Go Loud original podcast, which is called Lines of Inquiry. From ambitions of being an artist as a young child to becoming a detective with the Garda Technical Bureau, John has now turned to the True Crime podcast, only with a slight twist, because he is able to give his perspectives from the inside on some of the cases that he is discussing. He spent 20 years with the Technical Bureau, including time as a handwriting expert, and John is with me now. John, good morning and welcome.
Hello, Pat. Thanks for having me here.
Now tell us, what makes a young fellow want to become a forensics expert?
Well, it was kind of like what makes a young fella not want to be a guard anymore, you know, because in
Well, how did you become a guard?
In my case, I had, as you say, I'd worked in art. I had a background in animation, worked in one of the studios here in Dublin in the early 90s. But
with Jimmy Murakami.
Jimmy Murakami, yeah. Murakami Wolf. We did the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and which was great. It was good money for, you know, I was just out of school. But when contracts dried up, they downsized, let a few of us go, and it happened to coincide with a big recruitment drive by the guards. And, you know, I kind of applied for it, not really thinking too much about it. And I kept getting past the next hurdle and the next hurdle and the next hurdle. And my only other option back then was either to, you know, try to find more work in the animation industry. I was kind of fed up with commuting in and out of town every day, or work at home on the farm with me dad, like, you know. But we both knew there wasn't a future in that. So I just kind of kept getting through the...
So you drifted into
it, into it. And before I knew it, I was in Templemore, like, you know, and, you know, back wearing a uniform, which I swore I'd never do after I left school. And here I was a couple of years later. But...
And what was it like as a callow youth being put on the beat?
I found it daunting because... And even though, like, my first station was lovely, quiet, leafy Malahide at the time, like, you know, you're talking the mid-90s, it was nowhere as big as it is now. But, you know, I had very little self-confidence, you know, and, you know, I was just didn't feel that I was a fit for the job rather than the job being a fit for me. And Malahide was great, but then, unfortunately... You know, after I finished training, I was put into the command and control centre for a few years, which means you're just, you know, you're dispatching cars, taking calls, stuff like that, but you're not gaining any experience. And, you know, when I finally got out of there and back to a station, you know, I really was, you know, very much a babe in the woods, like, you know.
And was there any particular crime that you came across that, and then you started looking at the guys who were doing the forensics and say, that's for me?
Well, it was some poor publican's misfortune to get glassed in his own pub one night, and I happened to accompany one of my colleagues into the fingerprint section with said pint glass to see if we could get fingerprints on it, you know, and I had never been in there before. I didn't know what it entailed. And I was immediately dazzled by this high-tech, you know, state-of-the-art section, because at the time they'd only recently got a new computer system in, and it was, you know, it was
This is
fantastic.
The APHIS system.
Yeah,
is
the APHIS system.
Because I often see it in the crime dramas on telly.
Yeah, the APHIS system, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, it was, you know, state-of-the-art at the time, and I just couldn't get over that, you know, these were all guards in here. They were plainclothes and they were detectives and they were doing detailed, exacting work, which, you know, I had an eye for, you know, going back to the art and the animation and stuff. So I got my foot in the door and I just kept my ear out for when there was any vacancies. And sure enough, within a year, vacancies were advertised and I was lucky enough to get into the fingerprint section.
And do you think your fondness for art had anything to do with that?
Personally, for me, yes, because, you know, I've always been a stickler for detail and getting things, you know, kind of perfectionism in my own drawings and whatnot like that. And the ability then to concentrate and maybe zone out what's going on around you. And what I did find, like, you know, I have said that I, as a young guard, I was, you know, severely lacking in self-confidence when I was out in the street or whatever. But I very quickly became confident in my own ability to do the work of a fingerprint expert. And, you know, I stuck with that then for 10 years within the Bureau before moving on then into the
And I suspect that handwriting is even more drawing on your artistic background.
Yeah, because a lot of the time when you're doing handwriting and signature comparisons, you're sketching, you're drawing things out, you know, you're trying to get a feel, or especially with signatures, you're trying to get a feel of the flow of the way the stuff is constructed, you know. And again, you know, maybe my artistic background lent into that, but my experience as a fingerprint expert certainly did me good going into the handwriting because I was used to detailed comparison.
Now, how do you train to be a handwriting expert?
It's the same with any kind of comparative science or discipline. Every time you pick up a piece of handwriting or a signature, every time you're exposed to writing, you're learning, basically, you know. It was the same with the fingerprint section. There is internal and external courses, and you have to pass these and whatnot. It was the same with the handwriting, and, you know, you had to be 5 years working within documents and handwriting before I could finally call myself an expert, you know. And I did some external training over in a handwriting place in Birmingham. I was 6 weeks there, and, you know, they were very, very good, and, you know, long
now,
days.
People would think in order to have a match that every T has got to be crossed the same way and every I dotted in the same way. But I would say to myself, you know, based on my handwriting being destroyed from taking notes in college for years, I might not write a word the same way twice.
Yeah, well, that, Pat, is one of the principles, really, of handwriting examination. Like, you know, that, okay, no two people will write exactly the same way. But you can also say that no one writer will write exactly the same way twice, because we're not machines, like, you know. And writing is really what your brain is telling your shoulder and your arms and your hands and your fingers to do. And then you have to take in all the variables, like what's the writing surface, the writing implement, your posture, all these things come into play, you know, tired, irate or whatever, like, you know, might have an effect. But with handwriting, it's really more of an analysis of variations. What you need to kind of get an idea of is the degree of natural variation within a writer's normal handwriting. And to get that, you would need, you know, you would need sufficient amount of writing so that you get, you know, combinations of letters, and, you know, letters will be constructed differently depending on where they are in a word, or maybe depending on if they're joined to certain other letters.
And I suspect even the implement that you use, if you use a fountain pen versus a ballpoint versus a pencil or a crayon, you might form a word in a different way.
Yeah, possibly. You know, most of the time, you know, the stuff that you get exposed to is usually your standard ballpoint stuff, you know. But I say you can never have too much handwriting for examination. And it goes the same, like, say, if you've got a question piece of writing, you need a sufficient amount of specimen writing as well. Yeah. So then you're comparing the degree of natural variation in two pieces of writing, and seeing if they fit, you know. But like, it's not like there's a percentage or a certain number you have to get to. That's where the expertise comes in, that over time you learn to give more evidential weight to certain features than others, you know.
And when you would go into court to testify, you would go in with a very high level of confidence that you got it right.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And like, very often you might go to court and you can only give a limited opinion or, you know, a less conclusive opinion because of maybe the simplicity of the writing or lack of sufficient amount of writing. Yeah. But I've never gone to court and not been fully, you know, convinced of my findings, because like with fingerprint identification and many other kind of comparative disciplines, there is a verification system. So say if I say something is conclusive, that would be checked by another expert and, you know, would agree.
Now, in your podcast series, Lines of Inquiry, you're not just doing handwriting cases.
No. We're doing a good mix of cases now in the first season. Some people would be aware of, you know, there's some, you know, murder cases there. There are missing person case there as well, hopefully. And, you know, there's a mixture of a couple of cases that I would have been involved in, but then many that I wasn't. But what we think with Lines of Inquiry that makes it maybe stand out from the other kind of true crime podcasts is that we have a level of authenticity to it, you know, that it's very fact-based. The scripts are checked by several people. And then I also have that kind of background.
The inside knowledge.
Knowledge to say that, okay, maybe that wouldn't be said like this, or maybe this would have happened, you know. And certainly with the cases that I was involved in, it gives a nice little bit of extra information maybe to the listener of what goes on behind the tape.
Well, let's talk about episode two, a case in which you were involved. It's the Midlands Letters. Beast is the title of the... So tell me about the Beast.
Yeah, well, that was a case that it just keeps following me around, like, you know. And nobody seems to have heard about it, but it was just so unusual that we decided to make an episode out of it, you know. And it entailed me just one day picking out the next file for examination in the documents and handwriting section. And this was a 23-page handwritten letter containing, you know, very, very sadistic and violent and explicit threats by, you know, the unknown author, saying that he planned to abduct and torture and kill college girls and this sort of thing. And, you know, he sustained that over 23 pages. And, you know, at that stage, I was already a seasoned, you know, member of the section. I'd seen a lot of nasty things.
But you're asking yourself, is this fantasy or is this someone who might actually carry through?
Yeah, like with this being the first letter that I'd seen, it just struck me that, you know, this guy seems so prolific that he can keep this up for this amount of time. Like, you know, and unfortunately, with no specimen writing, no suspects for me to compare it against, so there wasn't much I could do with it. Okay, it got checked for DNA and fingerprints. Again, DNA... a DNA profile was generated and fingerprints were found.
But unless you have someone in the database, it's no good to you.
It's no good to you now. And so I had to just file away the case and move on to the next one. But within a couple of months, two more letters came in. And as soon as I opened those, I recognized the writing straight away. And again, it was more of this intense kind of pent up violence and rage and, you know, very explicit and nasty stuff. And he was starting to make reference to other Irish women that had gone missing and been murdered, and saying that he would be, you know, he would make his victims suffer even more, like, you know. And that's where the name The Beast for the episode comes from, is that he called himself, he was going to be the beast of all sex beasts, and he was going to be a new serial rapist and killer, like, you know. So at this stage, I had three letters come, they had all come from different Garda stations and from different investigating members, but because I was able to say these are all written by the same person, I was able to communicate to the different Gardaí that you're all looking for the same guy, you know. And after that, things kind of moved a bit quicker because more letters were coming in, and I went back through the records and found even one from that predated my time in the document section by a few years. It had dated back to 2004. And what made that one more kind of chilling was that, as well as the usual really long, detailed plans about what he was going to do, like, I mean, he had times and distances to drive from village to village, how long it would take to stalk a girl and, you know, subdue them and transport them back to where he said he had a torture den, like, you know. But this particular letter, of which had, you know, been found in 2004, was actually found in a makeshift hide or den out in the woods out to the east of Tullamore town. And, you know, this consisted of a wheelie bin, which had been partially buried in the ground. And there was cable ties. I think that there was a hammer and a saw and pornographic material and more of these letters, like, you know. So he also had a notice board, I think, nailed to a tree, again, covered with newspaper cuttings and pornographic magazine cuttings and stuff like that. So, you know, it struck me then that, like, this guy has been writing this stuff for a long time and it seems to be escalating, you know. He's writing more and more and they're coming in, because throughout 2016 and into 2017, I was getting more letters in.
And so the question is, if this increase in escalation is going to lead to action by him.
Absolutely. And that was the fear now. And the investigating Gardaí in around the Midlands, and I think it was the investigation was kind of spearheaded out of Tullamore. Like, that was their biggest worry, because some of the letters had been sent directly to Garda stations, taunting that he was going to do these things. But then some of the letters were sent to schools, you know, girls, secondary schools. And in one of those, he actually named six students, like identified them, and said, you know, who they were, their ages. He said he knew where they lived. He'd been following them. He'd been watching them and stuff like that. So, you know, it was feared that he was going to take the next step. Like, if everything before this had been fantasy, which, you know, we couldn't be 100% sure of because we didn't know who he was, but it was only going to take a very small push for him to go that next step. And, you know, like, the Gardaí were doing everything to try to find out who this guy was. They had identified a few suspects. I was getting samples of writing in. None of them were matching, you know. And I don't want to give too much away, but I say that the episode has been out anyway. But it was, you know, a bit of luck and, you know, a bit of local knowledge maybe on behalf of a recently retired Garda member that a suspect was nominated. Yeah. And as soon as they got a sample of his writing, like, if this was a course of business, you know, forms, applications, he wouldn't have been aware that
they were
looking at him.
Because if they went for a DNA test, he would know that they're suspecting him.
Yeah.
But like, just filling in a form?
Yeah. Incidental course of business writings. Yeah. And once I got those, I was like, that's him, you know.
And was it as instant as that?
Well, it was instant to me when I saw it. I knew that's him. But, you know, officially and, you know, the correct procedure is to go through the whole analytical comparison thing, which I did, you know, and do my report and get it checked and it goes out. But I knew the minute I saw it because I'd been exposed to so much of this writing over such a long period of time that I knew it, like, you know.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. Eight episodes in this series of the podcast?
Eight episodes in the first season, yep.
And it is called Lines of Inquiry, and its author, its presenter, John Sweeten. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat. Thanks very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.